Okay, good morning, everybody. First, a good Chodesh, month of Tammuz. We know that it's interesting that Rav Tzadok points out a very interesting observation that we might not notice. Tammuz was supposed to be the actual month that Moshe Rabbeinu would have come down with the Luchos, meaning we heard the Aseret Hadibros on Shavuos. But the 40th day was the day that Moshe Rabbeinu would have brought the Luchos Rishonos. Unfortunately, what happened was the Chet HaEgel, and he smashed the Luchos Rishonos. But in a sense, had there not been the Chet HaEgel, the 17th of Tammuz would have been a great day of rejoicing. It would have been the revelation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah. So in effect, this is a month where we think about the lost opportunities, that there are opportunities in life that have so much potential, so much goodness, so much joy, and we squander them. And in a sense, that's worse than simple suffering. Suffering is suffering. Suffering is bad, or at least difficult. I shouldn't say bad, but it's difficult. But when you realize what you could have done, what we could have done, the potential that we could have taken out of life, and we did not, that is what we call tragic. Right? Tragedy in the Greek sense, and Lahavdil, Judaism, I think, would embrace that idea, is not simply being a nebuch, but tragedy is when there was a potential for greatness, and that greatness was frustrated. And indeed, that is exactly the story of Korach. We know that Korach was a very, very great person. In fact, it was that greatness that led him astray. Korach saw, number one, that Levim, who would sing in the Beis HaMikdash, would be descended from him. We have 11 kapitlach of Tehillim, which are B'nai Korach, because the B'nai Korach did not die. At the last moment, they did tshuva, and they survived, and they had children and grandchildren and descendants. And they became the Levim in the Beis HaMikdash, Shmuel HaNavi, who is considered to be Shakol, equal to both Moshe and Aaron, comes from Korach. So Korach did what you call reverse engineering. You know, we say the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, so if you have a good apple, you must have a great tree. He says, it must be me. It must be me. That's why there's a Shmuel, why there's B'nai Korach, and everything else. Of course, some Sfarim point out that it's the opposite dynamic. It's very, very fascinating. What made the righteousness of Shmuel and the B'nai Korach is precisely they saw what happens when a person rebels against the Torah. And as for Keres, instead of Korach saying, I'm going to lead my rebellion because I have these great descendants, those great descendants emerged only because of the lesson that was taken from the rebellion against Korach. But nevertheless, Korach had greatness. According to Chazal, Korach even understood the secret of the Parah Aduma. He understood the mystery of the Parah Aduma, the greatest mysteries of the Torah. So Korach had tremendous greatness. But what's fascinating is he was consumed by arrogance, by gaiva, by kavod. Now the Netziv points out that there were really two groups here. There is Korach with Dathan and Aviram. And then the second group are 250 people who wanted to bring incense in place of the Kohanim. And we know that Korach, how Korach died is actually a very big machlokas. The Chumash is not clear how Korach died. But Dathan, the Aviram, and most of the people who were with Korach, they died by the ground opening up and swallowing them. The 250 people did not die by the ground swallowing them. They died because as they brought their ketores, a fire came from Hashem and consumed them. And the kalim, the censer we call it, in which they had the coals in which they burnt the ketores, was actually beaten and it was used to be a cover, a plating for the Mizbeach. Now, how Korach died is a machlokas in the Gemara, and there are even other midrashim that give you additional views. Did Korach die by the ground swallowing up? Did Korach die in the fire of the people who were Matir the Ketores? Did Korach die both ways, meaning first he was burnt and then the ground opened up? According to one view, which is a very strange view, Korach died as part of the 14,000, because after this whole incident, there were people who complained to Moshe that, you know, you're killing us all. So there was a Mageva in which 14,000 people died, and Korach just died as part of the Mageva. Now that's a very difficult medrash to understand. In other words, Korach died like anybody else. Nothing unique, nothing special. The leader of the revolt just dies in the middle of 14,000 people. But I think that's the ultimate mussar, that's the ultimate shtach. You think you're special? You're not even going to die special. Yeah, I'm going to make a great miracle for the people who join you, but you're going to die as part of the crowd. Again, it's kind of really deflating. You don't even die heroically. But the Netziv's point, to go back, is that the 250 were different than Korach. Korach was seeking kavod, glory, the arrogance of power. They wanted to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through the incense, and they knew they would die, just as Nadav and Avihu, who brought Ketores in a way they weren't supposed to bring, died. But they wanted to die just to taste the Dveikus to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for a split second. They died, although it was an Aveira, it certainly was an Aveira, but this was an Aveira that was done L'shem Shamayim. And that is why their Aveira gets a memorialization as a Tzipoy L'Mizbeach, meaning there's a double function. On one hand, it's a Tzipoy L'Mizbeach, so that every non-Kohen who feels like bringing a Korban on his own sees that Tzipoy and remembers, oh yeah, I better not do that. So it's a reminder, but also it's a bit of a tribute. It's a memorial tribute to those people who erroneously wanted to reach Hashem by violating His mitzvot, but their kavana was l'shem shamayim. So the Netziv is machalik between Korach and the 250 people, and perhaps that is why the Torah does not give us their names or their identities, because since they acted l'shem shamayim, even though it was a great aveira, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was chas on their kavod. HaKadosh Baruch Hu had sensitivity to their dignity by not mentioning them. There's a similar idea by the Mekoshei Sheitzim, by the one, we're going to read, about the one who was gathering wood, and they didn't know what the punishment was, so Moshe asked Hashem, and Hashem said, you have to stone a person who is Mechalel Shabbos. There is, according to one opinion in the Gemara, that this person was none other than Tzlavcha. Tzlavcha did not die because of Korach. In fact, the daughters make the point, right? Daughters say, he did not die with Adas Korach, he died because of his own sin. And the obvious question is, well, that's not so much of a credential. I mean, he says, you know, he didn't do that, he had his own sin that he died for. Like, what are they trying to build up? So according to one opinion in Masechet Shabbos, he was the Mekoshei Sheitzim. Now you might say, well, so what? That doesn't sound like a great credential either. So Tosos explains, he brings from a Medrash, that the Mekoshei Sheitzim was also L'shem Shemayim. Because after the Chet HaMeraglim, many Jews had the attitude, if we're not going to come to Eretz Yisrael, then why should we keep the Torah at all? The Torah is the national law for the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael. So if we're going to go to Eretz Yisrael, we got to prepare. But if we're not going to go, why do we have to keep the Torah? So he deliberately desecrated Shabbos, knowing that he would die. Because remember, Moshe didn't know which death, but he knew Mechalel Shabbos gets the death penalty. So this person knew he would die one way or the other. But his kavana was l'shem shamayim, to teach Bnei Yisrael the imperative of keeping the Torah, and as a result, the Bnos Lovcha can rightfully say to Moshe, our father was not like Korach, who rebelled and wanted to undermine the authority of the Torah. Rather, our father was machaveh l'shem shemayim. That's the idea. And yet, the Gemara points out that Salavchad is not identified. The Mekoshesh is left unnamed. Once again, the very fact that he was machaveh l'shem shemayim, but since he did an aveira, the Torah is sensitive to not revealing his identity. In fact, there's even an opinion in the Gemara that criticizes the sages for revealing his identity. They basically said, if Hashem didn't want to tell us who this was, why are you telling us who it is? Meaning, if you're wrong, and Slavchad is not the Mekoshesh, you're saying Motzi Shemra, and if you're right, you're saying Lashon Hara, because the Torah wanted to keep it secret. All right, so you're not going to win one way or the other. Now, what's fascinating is this, though. What's fascinating is that what is the essence of Korach's argument? So Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Yosher Ben Soloveitchik writes that Korach was the proponent of what you might call the common sense rebellion. Korach is essentially making an argument based on anarchy. He says, we're all equal. All Jews are holy. All Jews are good. All Jews heard HaKadosh Baruch Hu at Har Sinai give us the Aseret HaDibros. Why do we need rabbis? Why do we need leaders? Why do we need Moshe Rabbeinu? Korach is making the argument of what we might call radical egalitarianism. That everybody is equal. Rebbe Yosef has his view, and I have my view, and so very good. We're all kind of equal. And if this sounds ludicrous when I mention Rebbe Yosef, think what it sounds when I mention Moshe Rabbeinu. But nevertheless, that was the idea of radical egalitarianism. There was a very famous, very infamous or famous politician in American history around the time of the Depression, Huey Long, who was a populist and perhaps a communist. It's not really clear, but there was actually a possibility that he would become president. He was assassinated. And his motto was, every man a king. And even then, he wasn't including women, but he said, every man a king. And he says, we don't need authority, we don't need central government to tell us what to do. Now, what's fascinating is that Korach's argument is pitched on egalitarianism, but Moshe responds to it based on hierarchy. Moshe Rabbeinu says to Korach, don't you have enough kavod as a Levi? That Hashem separated the Levi to serve Hashem, and you have to be a Kohen as well. Now, L'chaira, you would think it's kind of a non sequitur. Korach was not making the argument, I want more kavod. Korach was making the argument, everybody's equal. So why is Moshe Rabbeinu making the argument that, Hamad, don't you have enough kavod? The short answer is that Moshe Rabbeinu understood that there was a hidden agenda. That those who call for egalitarianism, overthrowing the power structure, are not really interested in equality. They're just interested in substituting one authority for another authority, namely themselves. Moshe saw through this right away. You're not making an argument you want everybody to be equal. You're making an argument that you want to be the boss. And again, Rashi explains, based on the Medrash, that there were certain positions. Korach was a cousin of Moshe Rabbeinu. Amram had four sons. I'm sorry, Kohath rather, had four sons. Amram, Yitzhar, Chevron, Uziel. Right, these are the four sons of Kohath, the son of Levi. Amram is the oldest, so he got a double portion, Moshe and Aaron. Moshe was the Melech, so to speak, and Aaron was the Kohen. But then, the Nasi of the Shevet of Levi was the son of Uziel. Elitzafan ben Uziel. So Korach initially said, if Amram the Bechor gets two positions, then I'm for the son of Yitzhar, I should get a position. So as a result, he uses the argument of egalitarianism to get together a whole bunch of malcontents. The Eben Ezra explains, everybody is unhappy in their own way. There were Levim that were unhappy that they were not Kohanim. Dasan v'Aviram from Shevet Reuven are unhappy that the Bechira was taken away from Reuven all the way back from Yaakov's time when he took it away from Reuven. And he's claiming we should have the Avaita. There are firstborns that are claiming we would like the job instead of Kohanim. So everybody is in it for their own reason, but they're using the argument of equality as a way of bringing people together. This was the tremendous insight of Mrs. Own Ben Pelas, right? Own Ben Pelas is mentioned at the very beginning of the Parsha as a person who was part of the revolt, but he seems to be not mentioned anywhere else. He makes a very brief cameo mention, and then he's gone. And the Gemara says on the Pasuk, Chochmas Nashim Bonsa Besa, the wisdom of a woman builds her house. Chosfa Amudeha Shiva, she excavates her house with seven columns. We'll talk about that. The Avelas Biadeha Tarsena, but a foolish woman destroys her house with her bare hands. The Medrash says, who is the wise woman who built and preserved her house? This is the wife of Own Ben Pelas. And who is the woman that destroyed their house? It's the wife of Korach. Korach comes home with his various grievances, even including the fact that when the Levium were purified, they were shaven, so he looked like a baby, no hair on his head or his face. And she said, what is this? And she said, well, Moshe Rabbeinu did it to 30,000 Levium. And she said, he did it to get you. He just did it to everybody else to give him an excuse. And she added gasoline to the fire. And she contributed to the idea of resentment and machlokas, which eventually destroyed everything. Own Ben Pelas' wife was very practical. He comes in, rah, rah, democracy, a new way, we're all equal, we're all kings. She says, very frankly, like a good wife should, you are an idiot. She says, if Korach wins, you'll be a nobody. And if Moshe wins, you'll be less than a nobody. He says, you have no role to play in this. She didn't use spiritual arguments. She didn't give him, you know, Musar, Torah, Hashkafa. She just said, can't you see that you are not going to get anything out of this whatsoever? She was a realist. And she was kind of open. You know, remember that when Korach's men went to get him, she uncovered her hair, and they wouldn't even enter the tent. It's interesting. They're morating against the whole Torah, but they're not going to enter a tent with a woman's uncovered hair because they have to look from the chalapachas. Right? They have to look good. And because of the practical wisdom that she had, very practical wisdom, this is not like a spiritual wisdom necessarily, she was able to be matzil. Because she understood that all of these politicians, and without applying it to today, but all of these politicians, they're talking about fairness and equality. It is just a matter of replacing one power structure against another power structure. So you're going to be the same boat no matter who wins. So why should you do this? Why should you get involved with this? Okay, hidden agenda. You know, those of you may remember George Orwell wrote a book, Animal Farm, and this was a parody of the Russian Revolution, in which the animals revolted against the human masters because the human masters were so oppressive. And this was the interest of liberty and equality and freedom. And eventually what happened is that some of the animals that were running the farm, they became even more oppressive and domineering than the humans, and they eventually began to look like human beings. I think Napoleon, the name was chosen deliberately. And George Orwell was making the point that these great revolutions, the Russian Revolution, let's overthrow the Tsar is so cruel, and of course the Tsars were cruel. And what did you get? You got Lenin and you got Stalin. And in the 70 plus years of communist rule, what was done to Yiddishkeit and Torah in the Soviet Union was worse than anything that happened under the Tsars. What Stalin was able to accomplish in his, whatever, 40 years was more than 500 years of the Tsars were able to do. To mamash, almost extinguish Torah and Yiddishkeit. Lagamri. The French Revolution. Egalite, fraternite. Liberty, equality. You get Robespierre, to overthrow Louis the 15th, whatever, 16th, what, 16th, I remember. But you get Robespierre. Now, one might say the American Revolution might be a Yotze Min HaKlal. Okay, I'm not going to address that particular issue. But generally speaking, one of the lessons of Korach is the notion of hidden agendas. And in some subtle way, sometimes an agenda might even be hidden to yourself. Meaning, you think you're acting, we think we're acting l'shem shamayim, we think we're acting for the cause of justice, the cause of equality, the cause of fairness. But really, it's a personal grievance that we have that we can't get over. You know, it's interesting that the famous Nida Yehuda, the great Rav of Prague, Rabbi Cheskel Lando, very, 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 very great, one of the truly, truly great poskim of the past 500 years. Rabbi Cheskel, in fact, I remember, just as a digression, apropos of nothing, but just since I mentioned his name, so I'll mention that, you know, when Hitler thought, Yimach Shemo, that he would eradicate Am Yisrael, he was afraid that nobody would even remember there was a Jewish people. So they would not celebrate his great accomplishment, because there wouldn't be any Zecher of Am Yisrael. So Hitler, in kind of a bizarre way, obsession, created a great museum of Jewish artifacts in Prague, right, in order to kind of show people there was this Jewish nation that I destroyed. And this became the Precious Legacy, it was called, and this was about 20 years ago, I don't know where it is now, I guess it's in Prague, but for a while, for around 2 years, around 20 years ago, it was a traveling exhibit. So it came to Washington, D.C., where I was living in Silver Spring, Maryland, so near Washington. So I went to see it in the Smithsonian. And most of the stuff, you know, what can I say, Kiddush cups and Havdalah things, it wasn't particularly... but then I'm walking by, and I see a little notebook, again, behind glass, a notebook opened up to just notebook, faded writing on yellow paper. And nobody was paying attention because it certainly was not as beautiful as the tapestries and the Havdalah cups. But this was the original notebook of Rabbi Cheskel Lando, writing his Chidushim on Maseches Brachos, which is a Tzlach, it's one of the great, great Sfarim. So I have to say most people didn't pay any attention at all, but I can tell you that that by far was the most precious thing in that exhibit, the Ksav Yad. But the reason I'm mentioning him is this. In addition to his many, many responsa, his many tshuvos, this is the Nota B'Yehuda, again, one of the truly, truly great Sifrei Psach, and his Chidushim on Gemara, which is called Tzlach, which is an abbreviation, Tziyun L'Nefesh Chaya, this was in memory of his mother Chaya, Tziyun L'Nefesh Chaya. He also had a book of drushas, you know, different drushas. And one of the drushas was the hesped for his wife when she was Nifter. Gave a hesped for his wife. And you know, most has paid, and particularly husbands to wives or men to women, don't talk about the person that much, at least in writing. But you know, tzniyism isn't that. So most of it was general Torah, etc. But he did say some specific things about his Rebbetzin and how much she meant to him. And she said, you know, being the Rav of Prague was a very tough job. There were times that there were insults and bizyainess and people behaved in awful ways. And he says, I often got angry. I often got upset. And when I would come home, my Rebbetzin always told me to take it in perspective, to understand that people don't always mean bad things, and to look at people as chus. And she diffused all of the anger and resentment that I had. He said, he writes, and because of this, I was able to effectively make the decisions and the psukim that needed to be made, because I was able to factor out the anger and resentment that a human being normally feels. This is a very, very honest admission from a great, great gadol. And this is truly one of the roles of an Ezer Kenegdo in life. Korach's wife poured gasoline on the fire that he felt. And Ohn Ben Peles, perhaps in a less delicate way, perhaps she was kind of a tough love, but she made him see it, not necessarily by being warm and fuzzy, but she made him see it by making him see reality. And this is the Chachmas Nashim Bansa Besa, the wisdom of a woman building a home. to take away the anger, take away the resentment. Because in any issue of life, in any matter of life, when we're consumed with angers and resentments, our minds are not functioning right. Number one, spiritually, we're not connected to Hashem, because Kas removes us from a Dveikus in the Shechina. The Gemara says a Navi cannot have Nevuah in a state of anger. And rationally, you know, our minds don't function well because, you know, I'm going to kill him, I'm going to shoot him, I'm going to rip him up, you know, whatever it's going to be. You know, our minds are not going to make the right decision until we get into a state of calmness and reality. And this was the difference between Korach, Mrs. Korach and Mrs. Ohn ben Peles. Now the thing is, just in terms of the other pasuk, I mentioned that the pasuk says, Chochmas Noshim Bansa Besa, the wisdom of a woman builds her house. Chatzwa Amudeha Shiva, she excavates it with seven columns. Viavelas Biodeha Tarsana, and a foolish woman destroys the house with her hands. So what is the reference to the seven pillars, just to go there? What does it mean, she excavates her house with seven pillars? So as an aside, the Gemara in Shabbos says, this refers to the seven books of the Torah. Seven books of the Torah, that sounds a little strange. Aren't there five books of the Torah? That's why we call it a Chumash. So the Gemara says that Sefer Bamidbar is divided into three books of very, very unequal length. The first book of Bamidbar is Bamidbar and Naso, the first two parshios, and half of Baloscha until we leave Har Sinai. We were at Har Sinai for almost a year. We came Rosh Chodesh Sivan, we left around the 20th of Iyar. Then you have two verses about our traveling by Yi bin Soah Harav, and that is book two, just two verses. And book three is the rest of the book of Bamidbar. So you have seven, right? Because Bereishis, Shmos, Vayikra, Devarim is four. Bamidbar is three. Now you have seven books of the Chumash. But it's a little odd. Why would we divide Bamidbar into three? And why would the middle book only be two verses? What type of book is only two verses? So Rav Tzadok is masbir that part one of Bamidbar is HaKadosh Baruch Hu creating the ideal society of holiness. How to create Kedusha. You have the Mishkan in the middle. You have the Levium that represent, I think we talked about this, Torah, Avodah, Gemilas, Chasadim. And then you have every Shevet with its role and its flag and its mission. And you banish the impurities from the camp. So part one of Bamidbar is the ideal. Part three of Bamidbar is the sordid reality of everything falling apart. Because if the three sanctifications of Am Yisrael come from Torah, Avodah, Gemilas Chasadim, the three machrivim of Am Yisrael are kina, jealousy, taiva, lust, and kavod, the desire for honor. And all of those themes dominate the third part of Bamidbar. Taiva, when they didn't want the man and they needed to have meat, even though the man could be whatever they wanted it to taste like. Kavod, some say the Meraglim was kavod. They didn't want to go to Eretz Yisrael, the Zohar says, because they thought they would lose their jobs. Kina, jealousy, is of course the story of Korach. So it's like a picture and a negative, if you remember the old, if anyone remembers the non-digital cameras of our youth. And the concept basically is Torah, Avodah, Gemilas, Chasadim equals Kedusha is part one. Kina, Taiva, Vakavite equals destruction of Kedusha, part three. Book two is the transition and the reason for the fall. Leaving Har Sinai. Rashi explains, when the Jewish people after 11 months were finally given permission to leave Har Sinai. They couldn't leave until the cloud of glory, the Anan HaKavod, gave them the signal. They left with great enthusiasm. They were Ketinok HaBoreach MiBeis HaSefer. They were like a child doesn't say the last day of school, but I would add that it's like a child on the last day of school. Right? You could get, I mean, it's dangerous to walk by a school or the last day of school. You are going to get run over by the stampedes. Because their attitude was, hey, we've been here only a year and we've gotten all these mitzvos. If we stay longer, we'll get more mitzvos. If we can get out of here, let's get out of here. Of course, that didn't help them because Lamai said they got mitzvos later on in Arbos Moav as well. But okay, but they thought they wouldn't get any more mitzvos. So Rav Tzaddok says, how do you go from the glory and promise of the Machanos and the Shvatim and the Degolim to the sordid reality of Kinataiva Bekavoy through the attitude that you have when you're Ketino Kaboreach Mibes HaSefer? Everything falls apart. Because what makes a person close to Hashem is not simply the quantity of mitzvos that they do, but the attitude with which the mitzvos are done. You do mitzvos, you learn Torah. But you do so as if it's a burden that you'd rather get rid of, but Nebuch, what can you do? Then there could be a tremendous, tremendous yirida. If not for the first generation, then for the later generations. Rav Moshe Feinstein used to say, a very famous statement, that the old Yiddish saying, Sishver Sazayni Yid, it was difficult to be a Jew. That destroyed a whole generation because, again, in the 1920s or post-World War I, it was very difficult to be a Jew. People lived in poverty. There were no protections for Shomer Shabbos people. If you got a job and you didn't show up on Saturday, then next Monday morning, because Sunday was off in America, next Monday morning you had to look for a job. In fact, even the origin of early Shabbos morning minyanim in America, Hashkamah minyanim, which synagogue rabbis don't like because people use it to avoid hearing the Rav's drasha. But usually the way most Orthodox shuls work in America is the Hashkama Minyan tends to be the province of the more from B'nai Torah who don't like drashas but they want to learn after davening and the like. But they should know that technically the Hashkama Minyan was the Mechalel Shabbos Minyan. The Jew who wanted to keep Shabbos but because of Parnassah, was not Omeid B'Nisayon, so they would go to an early Shabbos morning service so they could go to work afterwards. It was B'davka, not the Frum Minyan, so to speak. To sit in judgment on people that had really unbelievable sacrifices, it's not our role, because none of us knows if we would have that koach. Baruch Hashem, we don't face those problems. Even in Chutz La'aretz, we don't face those problems. And Kal V'Chomer, Baruch Hashem, here in Eretz Yisrael. And even then, there were some heroic people. This is before there were yeshivos and before there were legal protections, who indeed, every week, looked for a new job. And they were Meiser Nefesh Gomor for Shabbos Kodesh and for Kashrus and things in which there was no infrastructure at all in America for this type of life. But the attitude that was sometimes conveyed was the struggle of Judaism, how hard it is, and it was hard. But Rav Moshe said, that attitude is a bit poisonous to the next generation. Because kids grow up in a free society, and they can do whatever they want. A person might say, why do I have to live such a hard life? I could have things easier, I could be liberated. And Rav Moshe said that only when Yiddishkeit is conveyed as a joy, as a wonderful thing, then we can get our children involved in this. This is an issue, and that, by the way, is an issue we face even today. Baruch Hashem, you can get a job as a Shomer Shabbos, that's not a particular nisayon today, obviously. But the attitude of is Torah a burden, is Torah a joy, that's something that's very, very significant in the whole issue of kids at risk and the whole phenomenon that all of us have to deal with. So Rav Tzaddok says, part one is the glorious ideal. Part two is the awful realization of failure. Part three, rather. Part two, the reason for going from one to three is Ketinai Kabayreach Mibes HaSefer. Now, Rav Tzedek points out in the two psukim of Vayihi ben Soa Arel, in the Sefer Torah itself, those two verses are set off by nuns. A nun at the beginning and a nun at the end. And the nun is inverted. It's turned in the opposite direction. And this is a halacha. The Sefer Torah must be written with two nuns, two backwards nuns, not upside down, backwards nuns, bracketing Vayihi ben Soa Ha'aron. Rav Tzedek says, what is the logic or reason for nun? We know that nun is a symbol of nefila, falling down. The Gemara in Brachos says that that's why Ashrei, which has a pasuk for every verse, begins with a different letter of the alphabet. There is no pasuk that begins with nun. We go from Mem to Samach, Malchuscha Malchus Kol Olamim, and then we say Somech Hashem L'chol Anoflim. There is no nun, and the Gemara of Yochanan says in the Gemara, because nun is about Nefila, the falling down of Israel. David HaMelech didn't want to begin a pasuk with even a letter that suggests Nefila. It is only in the next verse, Saimeich Hashem, Hashem supports L'chol HaNoflim, that we mention Nefila only in terms of Hashem supporting, but we don't begin with Nefila. So nun represents Nefila. Vayihi ben Soa Ha'aron is bracketed by nuns because it is that attitude that causes Nefila in life. But why are they inverted? Because side by side with that message, the Torah wants to teach us that all Nefila is reversible. That Nefila doesn't have to be that way. We can change our mindsets. We can change our feelings. Right? We sometimes just say, that someone once said, the most destructive words in the English language is, that's just the way I am. Just the way I'm says, Spartan, that's it. I am what I am and that's it. No. It's true that we are what we are. I mean, I'll admit that to be a true statement. But the notion that I cannot change for the better is totally destructive. Obviously it contradicts the idea of tshuva. It locks a person into destructive habits and behaviors and attitudes and angers and resentments. And the ability to become someone different, but really becoming someone different actually means attaching yourself to who you really are, the holiness of your soul. It's not really becoming somebody different. It's a very, very important idea. And that's why Rav Tzedek says, Nefila is reversible. It is never a one-way street. That which you can destroy. No, it's interesting. I had one of the nice things of Eretz Yisrael is that you can hear Musar, you know, even from people who are not rabbis or teachers. You know, I had when I was in the States, whatever for various reasons, there was a dog that really severely tore my pants legs, and it was my son's dog, so I couldn't do anything about that. But the thing was that in America, they said, can't fix it, you gotta get new pants. Can't fix it at all. Okay, couldn't do it. So I thought, okay, there's really nothing you can do. I went to the Mumchim in America, couldn't fix it. But I went to Taylor and Meir Sharon. I guess Meir Sharon, I guess people are less willing to buy new stuff, so whatever it is. So he said he could fix it, yeah, no problem. He didn't even think it was a problem. And he fixed it absolutely beautifully. I was very, very, at a very low price, by the way. I'll give you the name later. He's told me, I mean, he wasn't Mechadish this word, but I said, this is amazing that you could fix this. He says, anything that's destroyed, Kal Shemesha, Ef Sharlit Kalkel, Ef Sharlit Takin. So, good. You know, it reminds me, when we saw Cilantro, legend has it, I'm not sure if it's true, that one of the things that inspired him to devote his life to teaching people about Avodas Hashem and Musar and Tikkun Amidos was he was once in Vilna towards twilight, towards sunset. It was getting dark. And he noticed a shoemaker. This is before there was electricity. And the shoemaker is stitching shoes, leather shoes, by the light of a flickering candle. And, you know, he's squinting and he can't really see, but he has to be accurate. And he says to the shoemaker, he says, "Why are you working in this darkness? Why can't you save it till tomorrow?" And the shoemaker said, in Yiddish, "As long as the candle is burning, there's work to be done." And Rabbi Sol Salanter realized, the Pasuk says in Mishlei, "Ner Hashem Nishmas Adam." The soul of a person is a candle lit by Hashem. As long as we have life, our candle is still burning. There's good work to be done. He says that that idea inspired him. So it's so fascinating. You hear sometimes a great chachma. Kol she'efshar lekalkel efshar letaken. So, and that's what Rav Tzedek is saying, that the nun is nefila, but nefila is reversible. But to go back to what I said at the beginning, Korach is truly a Greek tragic figure in the Greek sense, because Korach had greatness, Korach had godless, Korach had great potential, but the gaiva just destroys everything. The Altar of Slobodka said that when there's gaiva, there is literally no room for Hashem because it takes over everything. On Yom Kippur, somebody gets Maftar Yonah when you thought you should have gotten Maftar. That's all you're going to think about. On Tisha B'Av, somebody got this Kina. Hashem, women should be grateful you don't get any of this because you don't have to worry about all of this kavod that goes through people's minds. But the Altar of Slobodka was being honest. The person is thinking about it. You know, they tell the story about a person on Yom Kippur when the chazan was saying the Nisan HaTokev, right? So one of the passages in the Nisan HaTokev, Adam Yisodo Me'afor, mankind, humankind, their foundation is from the dirt, the Seifa Le'afor, and at the end will go back to the dirt. So a man was sobbing and crying and praying, and the Rav couldn't help but notice, and the Rav didn't think this person was such a tzaddik, but he was very impressed. He said, I guess I didn't realize what a holy and righteous person this person was. Okay. Anyway, it comes mincha time, and you know, the Maftir of Yonah is a very big kavod you give to a distinguished person. So they called up somebody else. So this man started screaming. He says, this is the man who was crying before. He says, "You know, I am the most chashuv person in the show. How can you not give me Maftir Yonah? What type of place is this?" So the Rav was very, very shocked. So after Yom Kippur, he went over to the person and he says, "No, Reb Yid, you know, I just don't understand something. During Musaf, Adam Yisoda Me'afar, the lowliness of man, the insignificance of man, and you were crying and you were sobbing and you really believed it and you internalized it. How could you be so angry because you didn't get covered?" So he said, "When I'm talking to God, I'm a nobody. But compared to him, you know, he's worse than me, you know." So, that's the idea. So when there's kavod, kavod eats up everything. It really eats up everything. And this is what the Gemara says. That when you have a Baal Gaiva, the Baal Gaiva pushes Hashem out of the world. Because there's literally nothing else but my kavod that's involved. So here, let me share with you a word from the Arizal, an amazing word from the Arizal that makes this point in a very obscure way, but once you see the pshat, you see what a beautiful way. The Arizal points out a fascinating gematria. The Arizal points out that the gematria of Korach is 308. Korach is 308. And the gematria of Moshe is 345. The difference between them is 37. Okay, everyone has that? 37 is the gematria of Hevel. So, therefore, Korach plus Hevel equals Moshe, or Moshe minus Hevel equals Korach. That's what the Arizal says. He doesn't explain it. So This is explained by the Sefer, the Shem Mishmur, who says the following. He says, if we go back to the first machlokas in history, at least between human beings, it is of course Kayin killing Hevel. And Adam HaRishon, who represents the complete, perfect person, because Yitzir Kapav Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he together with Chava, they have two children. One is called Kayin, one is called Hevel, but they represent two dimensions of the human personality. Kayin, right? Chava called Kayin Kayin because she said, Konisi Ish Im Hashem. Now, Konisi doesn't mean I acquired, it means I created. When Avraham says Hashem is Kone Shemayim Boris, he does not mean God is the owner of Shemayim Boris. Kone is also a lesson of creation. So, the name of Kayin is, I am a partner with God in creating life. So, Kayin represents in his personality the aspect of man that seeks to create, to innovate, to build up society, to use his godly nature in initiative. That could be whether it's scientific, technological, medical, Torah learning, ruchnius. It is what you might call the egotism within man that drives man to accomplish. The good part of that is, without a sense of ego and an awareness of my power and ability, I would never do anything. We would just let the mosquitoes fester in the swamps, etc. A person needs a sense of their power and a sense of their ability. The downside is that too much of that attitude creates arrogance and gaiva. Hevel is exactly the opposite. The word hevel is breath, vapor, something that has no mamashus. When Shlomo HaMelech describes the futility of this world in Koheleth, he says repeatedly, Havel, Havalim, Hakol, Havel. Everything is temporary, transient, ephemeral, doesn't last. So Hevel represents the epitome of humility, self-abnegation. Problem is, that's a wonderful midah. That is the midah of humility and modesty. But taken alone, without a sense of ego, it becomes passive and ineffectual, in which everything is Hashem Yazor, and one never feels they have the ability to take initiative and do anything in the world. Goodness, pure goodness, can be very passive. So, on one hand, Hevel's Madrega is a holy Madrega. But when Hevel died, he needed rectification. This is where we get into Gilgul and reincarnation. So the Arizal writes that Moshe Rabbeinu was a Gilgul of Hevel. Because Moshe Rabbeinu, on one hand, is the un of Mikol Adam. He had the quality of humility, but at the same time, he coupled that quality with leadership, initiative. He did not allow his humility to be paralyzing and make him passive. And therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu elevated the neshama of Hevel by taking the anava of Hevel and combining it with qualities of leadership and malchus, to teach Torah, to be the Navi, to be the Manig, to be the Melech, all of these different roles. So now, the Shem Mishmul says, the Arizal means the following. Kairach had all the qualities of Moshe Rabbeinu, except for the humility. Korach equals Moshe minus the quality of Hevel. The creativity, the intelligence, the spiritual sensitivity, even on some level. Korach was Moshe without the humility. So now the gematria is so perfect. Moshe is 345. Korach, 308. Hevel, 37. If Korach would have had the Hevel, he would have been Moshe. Without the Hevel, he becomes Korach. And of course, the word Korach itself means to be stripped. A bald person is called a kireach because the hair is pulled out. Kireach is an expression the Gemara uses when a person loses all that he has. He's called a kireach mikan mikan. He loses it. So Korach became stripped of everything because he did not have the hevel of Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay, we'll stop here. We'll see you next week. Have a good Chodesh.